BBC Sounds.
Davy Scott here, popping into your classic Scottish albums feed with a bonus episode from BBC Radio Scotland. Now, when we sat down to decide which six albums to cover, and we were looking back at the 30 albums that we'd already covered, I realised that I'd mistakenly thought that we'd made an episode about Sulk by The Associates. I could hear the programme in my head. Turns out, I'd made another programme about the band, but not an episode of classic Scottish albums. So, a quick call was made to the great Alan Rankin, and so here, in all his unedited glory, is what we talked about when he joined me in the studio in Glasgow. First and foremost, like, really so exciting to kind of connect with that record again, and so many things about it that are surprising.
Mm.
When was that record made? 1982?
It was released in 1982. It was made in the latter half of 1981.
Right, so how long was that? 91 to
38 years ago.
So what is it to you when you do you listen to it? Is it something that you go back to
occasionally? Yeah, but sometimes I definitely don't for little years, because I kind of want to be surprised again. But yeah, it was an interesting time. I can remember being in the studio, and Lady Di was getting married, July 29th, 1981, and we were hard at it. Yeah.
Yeah, and obviously inspired by the Royal Wedding and
yes. Undoubtedly.
One of the first things I think going back to the record, and we'll maybe get into some other some of the history of The Associates as we go through, but we're focused on this. And the first thing that I think is so surprising going back to it is opening a record with an instrumental,
yes.
And it's not just that, is it? Because the following track, you make us wait a good minute before we hear Billy as well. But so what was that? What was that decision about? What was that? And talk us through a little bit.
Okay, well, the opening track, that's the instrumental. It's what we did when we recorded The Affectionate Punch in March and April of 1980. And then we went out and toured. We only actually played two songs from that album. So we wrote a whole new set. And the live set that we wrote opened with that instrumental, Arrogance Gave Him Up. But it was very much guitar-based, no keyboards. It was just me, the guitar, an amp and a space echo. So we just thought, let's do it again, but let's do it and let's make it more keyboards based this time on the album. We liked the sounds. We had all the synclavias there and all the expensive gear, and it was just really good to do.
One of the other things about the song as well, though, for me, again, just going back to all these years ago, the sound of it really puts you in that 1982 space, which was a kind of European space,
yes, it
sonically.
Was.
What was kind of feeding into that, into the music you were making at the time, Alan?
It was very keyboards based, but there was still there's guitar on every track, but there's an awful lot of keyboards, so with that track, Know That you mentioned, the second track, where it's a good over a minute before we were into the first verse. But again, that was one that we'd played 2 years earlier, live, but again, guitar bass. So by doing it that way, we could make it a lot more kind of even more mysterious and a bit more John Barry-ish. It's not got real strings or anything. It doesn't pretend to have real strings or anything. But it's got that kind of mystery about it, and we felt we could make it maybe even a little bit more Russian
or Jewish.
Well, it's got, and it also has that thing, doesn't it? And you use that trick all the way through Sulk of the kind of secondary hook. In that case, it's that beautiful piano thing at the front of it. In other tracks, like Bap de la Bap, it's the vocal hook.
Yeah.
And it's obviously reaches its kind of peak in Party Fears too, but that idea that you set a kind of different hook with a piano at the start of it. Is that something that you developed as a part of your writing, or was it as a part of the production more?
I think with something like Party Fears 2, hooks like that don't come along very often. So when they do, you use them immediately. There's a hook at the start of, say, Club Country as well. It's very arresting, but it's not a melodic hook in the same way that Party Fears 2 is. But it's definitely there. I mean, if I can listen to records and say, right, hook, hook two, hook three, you know, and I can go right back into the early 70s, you know. One just popped into my head there, Run, Run, Run by Jojo Gunn. That record's got six hooks in it. It's a masterpiece. It's only 3 minutes, 10 seconds long.
So what's interesting to me about that is because I know, or at least I know now, I actually didn't realise that you guys had actually started doing kind of cabaret stuff. Okay.
Oh, God, yeah.
So you know, learning songs. And you bring in to what is actually a pretty experimental record, Silk.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of those big sort of principles
are
based on. So that's what I'm sort of getting at. You deliberately used that concept of the instrumental hook, like the Beatles did.
Yes.
And, you know.
Yeah.
So further to that as a question, and I'll shut up in a minute.
Okay.
It's how much of that was during the writing process, or how much of that was like a production moment, Alan?
Depends on the songs. Let me see. Party Fears 2 and Club Country, we demoed both of these songs on one Sunday evening. When I say evening, I really mean night, i.e. from 9 p.m. till 9 a.m. in the morning on Monday. We demoed these two songs, and we knew that's what would get us signed to Warner Brothers, and we knew that that's what would be our first two hits. So they were very much done. All that we had to do was tidy them up sound-wise to make them singles and not demos. But there's definitely other things that you just let happen, because I think there's got to be some spontaneity in the studio, because the studio is clinical enough and dry enough anyway. So you want to leave some headroom for something to, you know, be there. And sometimes it can be a lot of the song, you know?
Yeah. That's great. And it also feeds into another thing. I'm really interested in listening back to this record, because funny you're saying that some of these things you were playing live, then you took them in the studio, but the versions that we hear on Silk, it's not four guys kind of playing real tight muso,
no,
kind of backing track.
No,
it's there's a different process about the way that you're sculpting the sound there. So, describe the recording process, just as a general thing, how you manage that on that record.
Let me see. Well, I think everything is definitely, I would say, drum and bass driven. We had a fantastic drummer, John Murphy, Australian guy, sadly now departed. And his dad was a jazz drummer, and he just brought all that stuff to it. But what we did with him was we said, you're not allowed any tom-toms. You know, all your toms are going to be snare drums, because we want maximum explosiveness. So we'll have, like, you know, we'll have a little thin one here, and we'll have a great big 9-inch Black Beauty here, and, you know, and we'll mix up, we'll put the snare on, take the snare off, put it on a little bit, because we just thought tom-toms are a bit shit, you know, just a bit drab. And we did things like we put three hi-hats cymbals on the bottom, so that it gave it a really great big metallic clunk, clunk. And this guy was, you know, he didn't weigh very much, so we used to feed him up all the time. And you've got to remember, he was Australian, you know, so we said, look, we're trying to make you strong, John. This, you know, you've really got to hit it to get a good sound. And he said, yeah, I know. And I can't do an Australian accent, but The thing was that he just squatted. He only paid rent in 4 months of the year. All the rest of the time, he was just squatting and he wasn't eating. We used to take him to parties and he'd be in people's bins.
Oh, God.
You know, looking for potato peelings. You couldn't take him anywhere, but that's what he was like. You know, so, but he did a good job anyway.
And that comes, that there's a real sense of that, particularly on that track, Bap Dilla Bap.
Yes.
Which is kind of,
no,
you know something, you see when I was listening to that?
Masterful drums.
Oh, it's really, so tell me how, let's talk through that track, because it is quite a, it's like almost like Music Concrete or something. It's like getting
it's like a
kind of assault on the senses.
Yes, it is.
Talk us through it.
We could have been, you could have, that song's very, very tight, it's angular, it's, you know, it's a bit angry, it's angst, and it's a bit tortured. And you could have gone through that song and then, you could have done that and then released and gone into a whole kind of great big, almost Pink Floyd-y type thing. But we didn't. We deliberately kept it tight. I suppose it's kind of like, you know, just when I'm doing that figure in my head, it's that's kind of like Gary Newman. He kept everything very tight as well. He never released, you know?
By which you mean there were never those moments of... Yeah.
You know?
So just very kind of... It's almost a... Yeah, there's no moments where the music lays back a little bit.
No,
it's just relentless.
It's all relentless, yes.
So I was thinking earlier on about some of those melodies all the way through it. There's a beautiful melody on the song No, mm-hmm. And all the way through the melodies are gorgeous. I wondered if Scott Walker was an influence not only on the singing,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of the melody writing.
Well, I don't know whether it's an influence on melody writing, but just as Bowie had listened to Scott Walker, obviously, Bill was certainly going to listen to Scott Walker as well. So he'd definitely done that. So how much it influenced Bill, I don't know. You know, it was not a name that came up often. We sometimes referenced it between ourselves, but it wasn't a name that came up all that often. But it was definitely there.
Yeah,
definitely there.
It just came up for me last couple of days, listening to music again. And also the other way around, when I was listening to Bap Dilla Bap, and I thought, my God, I wonder if Scott Walker heard this when he was making Tilt. because there is that kind of that sort of theatrical thing.
Mm-hmm.
But just let's move back onto the big sort of stories again. I think the other thing about Sulk is it's almost kind of back to front now. I know there are two different versions of The Running Order and all that. We'll get into that.
Oh, right? There's a US version, the UK version, yes.
But even then, I think it's like almost like the opposite of how you would sequence an album.
I know.
Right? The hits are on the second side, right?
Uh-huh.
And so was that deliberate? Was that something that was this you being arch, Alan? I'm not saying that you can be arch, but was this a kind of a statement?
Well, naturally, the record companies, they always want track one. Yeah, that's going to be this, and you know, and it makes sense, you know. Even with, you know, the name of the band, they want to up the front and flip again, bold face, and they want it 2 inches high. And where do we put it? In the middle, and you can hardly read it. You know, so there's a lot of things that we did. Did we do it to piss them off sometimes? Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, they say, why did you flipping sign to Warner Brothers? Because you did Bugs Bunny. You know, you just do it to annoy them. But having said that, Warner Brothers... when we signed to them, you know, they had Korova Records, Bill, what's his name, KLF.
Yeah, Drummond. Yeah.
Bill Drummond, his imprint. And that was all they had. They had Dollar and Modern Romance. They had absolutely Sweet Fanny Adams that was any good. So we knew that they would play ball with us, and we knew that they would give us the headroom that we needed. They wouldn't try and produce or bring in production values that we would just never accept, you know?
But again, I suppose you were able to deliver because you did actually deliver a couple of big hit records, right?
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things I'm going to say to you, I don't want you to take the wrong way, and I mean it with huge respect, is that when you do get to Party Fears 2 on this record, there's a sense of relief. Mm-hmm. Because Sulk is actually quite a tricky listen,
yeah,
right? in a brilliant way. Mm. You know, it's dense, it's full of ideas.
Yes,
but then when you get to Party Fears 2, it's like this just explosion of all this candy, and it's more than just candy, but the music ideas are so beautiful in it, Alan, and they're so sort of you know, yeah. Transforming, you know. Tell us about the process of coming up with that and how you recorded it.
Party Fears 2. We wrote the hook for Party Fears 2 was written in 1977 on the upright piano in my mum and dad's front room. And what we used to do was go out on a Saturday night, get absolutely bladdered, and then wake up on Sunday. This is a measure of how determined Bill was, because he used to come through on a Saturday evening from Dundee to Linlithgow. That's two trains. Then go back on Sunday evening. That's two trains all the way to Dundee. And in that short period of time, about 7 hours on a Sunday, and for some reason, you know, you're that age, you don't feel hangovers so much. So, and we wrote the keyboard part for that, the intro, the motif. And we said, that's pure gold, but we can't use it. We'll just have to plank that and use it later on. So we didn't touch it until late 1980. And then we didn't demo it until 1981. Yeah.
And the song itself, in some ways, because so much of Sulk is experimental, the song itself is actually quite a straight A-B-A-B.
Yeah.
Verse, chorus, verse, chorus song.
Yeah, that's it.
So was that written, once you did go back to it, did you go back to the piano and finish it that way, or was it finished in the studio? Describe that process.
No, right. Once we had the, we knew that would be the intro and that would be the release that came after the chorus. So you're right, a verse, a chorus, release, back to the intro and then back into the verse again. We had that mapped out. We knew exactly what was happening before we went into the studio. Yeah, and it was the same with Club Country.
Yeah, I'm going to come back and talk to you about Club Country,
but
let's stay on Party Fears 2 if we can. Mm-hmm. Again, the amount of hooks per square inch,
yeah,
is quite something. Mm-hmm. Even stuff in the background, stuff in the foreground. Talk to me about that. What's you? Because you're a guitar player, Alan, right? And I know you play keyboards as well, but I know that you think like a guitar player.
Definitely.
And so, were you layering all of that stuff up from that perspective, or were you working with other musicians? It's not an album that you listen to and you think, oh, there's four or five guys in the studio, right?
No.
So tell us the process.
It's literally, there was Murphy on drums, Dempsey played bass on two tracks, and I played everything else. That's it.
And experiment, because I think the record took a long time to make as well, didn't it?
No, it didn't.
I did not?
No.
Okay, that's a myth then. Okay,
no.
We can shatter that myth,
no.
Folks.
No, definitely. I remember we wrote a check to Playground Studios, which was in just off Camden High Road or wherever it is, the main dragon, Chalk Farm or something. And we wrote a check for 30 grand. And we said, right, Michael, we're giving you this check. That gives us first dabs on the studio. If we want to go straight for 7 weeks and not have a break for a day, then that's our prerogative. But that's unlikely to happen. We're more likely to do 3 weeks and then have a week break. And what Mike was happy with that, because he was Mike Hedges' Playground owner. He had Susie and the Banshees, he had The Cure, he had Bauhaus, and there was a couple of others who could just get in just to fill in. So in actual studio time, no, it wasn't all that long at all. I'd say about 7 weeks.
Okay, so that's
but
my,
over
that's
about
my mistake.
A 3.5 month period. Yeah.
Okay. Let's with first and foremost with reference to Party Fears 2, but then we'll maybe broaden it a wee bit.
Okay.
Let's talk about Bill as a singer, and I'm always fascinated by the way that singers work in the studio.
Yeah,
I've never spoken to you about this before,
right.
but with Billy. Was he a one-take guy? Was he a guy that you did many takes with?
No.
Put me on your shoulder in the
okay,
studio doing
right.
vocals with him.
Well, some singers, you've got to comp everything up, and that's the way you do it because it's just easier. So you might do 5 passes and you comp. No, Bill wasn't like that. It was just straight through. And he'd say, what do you think? And it was always amazing. It was just always, and it was such a punishment of luxury for me because, was that a band? I don't know.
Should be.
Because I thought all singers were like that. You know, so when I went on to produce other people, I was tearing my hair out. And I said, this is crazy. These people were taking 19 takes and they still can't get it right. I think the only thing that sometimes there might be something that, you know, maybe a plosive on the mic or something like that, a P or a B or something too guttural or too close, you know, something like that. That would be the only thing that screwed it up. But every take was just a variation on amazing, you know.
And it's brave singing.
Yes. Yes.
You know, look, if you think about something like Nude Spoons.
Yes.
With that kind of... Yeah, kind of stratospheric yelping, screaming.
Yes.
Is that improvised? Is that something that was written as part of the song, Alan, or was that something that happened in the moment?
No, that was one of these tracks that we Nude Spoons. That was one of these tracks that we just made up organically in the rehearsal studio in the late spring of 1980, and then went out and played that live along with. 11 or 12 other songs. So when we came to record that, it was just Bill doing really more or less the same thing. But because we hadn't played it live, we hadn't played live since February of 1981, when we came back to doing it again for Silk, it felt fresh again. That song, very acid trippy, you know, and Bill, when he was doing the lyrics about the silvery tea and I can't remember all the lyrics, but it was definitely about an acid trip where, you know, plants were shagging each other and stuff like that, you know, and the roads outside were... were carpeted, yeah. And they were blue. They weren't grey. It's just, I don't know.
I'm guessing that kind of vocal acrobatic was in some way a description of that experience as well. It's a beautiful, beautiful moment. Let's talk a wee bit about Club Country. We started talking about it, and then because you said that you made the demo of it, and then you essentially went in and tidied it up. I wonder if the reissue copy that I've got has got the demo of it on it, and I wonder if that tells us just a slightly more dramatic story than the way you describe it there, because the demo is incredible. It's like Iggy Pop or something.
Oh yeah,
you've got that kind of real visceral.
No, we didn't patch it up or anything. This we went and re-recorded it, but we knew what we had was never going to be radio friendly. Not like that. It just wouldn't do. So we deliberately tidied it up. And we didn't feel that we were stripping back to do that. We didn't feel that we were encumbering ourselves somehow holding back in any way. We just wanted, look, let's make sure we can hear the bass line because it's really, really important. Let's make sure we can hear the guitar because it's really, really important. let's put in these keyboard stabs on the synclavier and all the rest of it, and let's make sure you can hear the vocals, you can hear the backing vocals, and you, at one point there's three basses playing. Let's make sure you can hear all of them.
So you're telling me then that the demo has got all of those elements, we're just not hearing them very well. Is that because it seems like there's almost whole new, I think it's marvellous, right?
There are whole
new layers of music ideas that are revealed to me in the master version of it, and not just that beautiful string thing. Of course, you know that string thing, and the sort of way that the rhythm interlocks and all that. Mm-hmm. It's almost like the detail of it is a completely new level.
And we wanted to bring the detail out because you know, that whole thing came from the bass line. That so that was all there before the verse was there and before the chorus was there, although it's all got that same rhythm, you know, rumbling through it all the time. I can remember doing the take for that in the studio, and Mike Hedges and I had just been out in the early morning. We went up to Oxfordshire to check out the new SSL desks they had that they were making up at Solid State Logic there. And on the way back, I said, right, I want to do the bass line for Club Country. And Hedges is driving like 130 miles an hour in this flipping open-top sports car. And it was a TVR Tasman or something. And I noticed that the gear stick was beginning to melt. And I said, mate, is this car okay? And he said, yeah, it'll be fine. But anyway, on the way back, I started to get the toothache. So Mike said, don't worry, I'll sort it. So he disappeared, then he came back into the studio and he just handed me this bottle of Ballantine's, he said, and a bucket. He said, just put that in your mouth and just hold it there and then spit it out. Don't swallow it, otherwise you'll never get it done. But that's how I did it.
Okay.
maybe that added to the urgency. I don't know, because it was bloody sore.
Maybe it did. What's the whole thing about the sort of alternate track listen? Because for me, just as a listener, I love to hear 18 Karat Love Affair in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
I love the song.
Yes.
But it wasn't on the original.
We did an instrumental
version. Yes. So how did that all happen?
Well, I think it was a thing where, Party Fuse 2 had gotten to the top 10. Club Country actually sold more and would have got higher, but because of the flipping Scottish World Cup squad, we got bumped twice. So it didn't go, it only got to number 13. And then when we, 18 Karat Love Affair, now that as a whole song, again, was written in 1978 on that same piano, the whole song, and it was written in as a 60s pastiche. It was, you know, it was a very 60s melody, very 60s chord structure. Everything about it was a little bit retro. The only thing that wasn't retro was the lyric. It was about, writing into a columnist about a gay affair. You know? So that was the only thing that was weird about it. But I think in terms of, I think that was probably a tad too soft for us. We thought we'd maybe just, that was as far as we wanted to take it. That's why we took it off the album.
That's really interesting, and it comes back again what I was saying earlier on about the beautiful challenge of listening to Silk.
Yeah.
And some of the kind of things that it asks of you as a listener.
Yeah.
And there is that, you know, for me particularly as a kind of like such a pop head really. 18 Karat Love Affair to me, I think, God, I love that. It's so beautiful. But I see what you mean. So in a sense it didn't fit the manifesto. How much of that manifesto was a thing? Did you have certain rules for the band? How did that operate?
Not rules. No, I don't think you should ever ever set down rules. But you just felt, I didn't feel totally comfortable with it. It felt good at the time, but, you know, because then it's 6 months on before it comes out, and you know it's the obvious track for a single, you know, there's not another one there. And I think that's why we brought it out as a double A-side with Love Hangover. Now, I think our version of Love Hangover is much better than Diana Ross's. I'm sorry, Diana, but there you go.
She's a listener of classic Scottish albums, so you look at your email. But we started talking a wee bit about lyrics and about what the lyric of 18 Karat Love Affair tells us or otherwise. But it is a feature, isn't it, of your music, that mixture of very relatable lyrics, but also incredibly dense and what is this all about lyric. Was Billy a sole lyric writer, or did you work on lyrics with him?
No, I decided very early on with Bill. He was very, very enthusiastic, and he had folders full of lyrics, and they were a little bit immature. And so I'd say to him, look, Bill, this is just basically a spoonerism. You know, you can't be doing this all the time. That's not going to cut the mustard. So that's when when he's coming up with lyrics like The Luncheon Pack of Rottenham instead of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. You know, you can't do that. And then lyrics like... You better mortis lock the door afore he slips out in the night, baby. You know, you can't do that either. But we did it for demos. So that was the only time I stuck my oar in, because I think when people are learning to write lyrics, they need to make their own mistakes.
But what was your understanding working? I know you were so close to Billy and, you know, what was your understanding of what his lyrics were telling us about his life? Is there an autobiography in there?
There's an awful lot of not fitting in. An awful lot of not fitting in. So that's there in Party Fierce 2. It's there again, big time in Club Country. And, you know, but that's more about him or us not fitting into the kind of ephemeral club land of the new romantic stuff. You know, we just didn't fit in there. You see, Durrani and Durrani's and Spandau, they could be new romantic. We weren't that. We couldn't be post-punk. We weren't that. We might have been a little bit in 79-80, but by 81-82, no, we weren't. You know, so what the hell were we? And even being Scottish, we weren't Glasgow, we weren't Edinburgh. We were just flipping this, you know, amorphous nonsense. And, you know, what came out of Dundee? And anyway, we formed in Edinburgh, but, you know, I can't say that. The singer's from Dundee, so that's just the way it is. So
that not fitting in thing
it's a big
is
deal,
something,
yeah.
And his persona, I guess, as well. There's a thing when you look at the videos of the time. Yeah. There is a kind of detachment about it as well. And I wonder if that there's this. I think the sleeve for Sock is beautiful. By the way, that kind of is like. It's like the hotel that you would kind of like to stay in, but not really.
It was actually someone's. It was someone's massive greenhouse. One of these great big houses in Surrey, where the greenhouses were like, you know, it's where they grew pineapples and stuff. You know, a mega greenhouse. It's one of these places, and you know, we just let's have some purple light, some kind of green light. Let's uplight it. And let's give it all these kind of sumptuous colours that just fit with the music.
Yeah, and it really does. A couple of sort of more fun questions before we sort of wrap this up. Mm-hmm. How many of these stories? Because I hear that you guys were like in fruit juice and all that, and prayer sessions before you did recording sessions.
Fruit juice and prayer sessions.
No, but the legend is the kind of rock and roll excess around about Sulk. Mm-hmm. How much of it's true? How much of it is just?
No, we waited till the work was done, and then we'd have some fun. Bell could never hold his drink, never. He'd say, mustn't smoke. Then he'd have a drambuie to, like, loosen up his throat. And you know how, like, loads of singers, like, you know, it's the honey and lemon this, and they're all wearing scarves and everything. Bill never had any of that problem. None of it. So, you know, it kind of convinces me that most of that stuff that singers, it's just a load of crap. They're just not very good. So Bill would have drambuie. Has anyone got a wee tickler? And then, you know, but we'd only do that once the bulk of the work was done, you know. We would never, there was never any time. No, the work ethic was, you know.
I think where it strikes me, though, is what it says about not just the work ethic, but about the relationship that you two had.
Yeah.
And what do you think were the key elements that you both brought, not just to the associates, but more specifically to the recording of Sulk? What were the key complementary things between you two?
I think Bill liked that he could kind of, once a song was at a certain stage, he could say, oh, I'm just going to go clubbing for like 4 or 5 hours. And he would know that when he came back, I'd probably have done the keyboards to another 3 songs, you know, 5 different parts, 5 different hooks, and they'd all be great. So I think and I knew that when he was doing something, but having said that, I never wanted to leave the studio. I don't think that wasn't Bill slacking. When Bill was in the studio, it was very, very intense. I think the thing is trust. Trust and just an understanding, a non-verbal understanding. He just knew and I knew. And it was just, I think it used to annoy people sometimes. Because, you know, it wasn't even a wink or a look or... But there was, you know, just this invisible thread. And that's what made everything work.
And it's, yeah, I mean, it's there in the music to this day, I guess. The other, I suppose, big question, and not to down it, but having made 2 big records, mm-hmm. Sulk obviously has got the mm-hmm. hits on it, and... Mm-hmm. You then basically don't make another album as a duo.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So all of that kind of magic that you'd built up is then kind of gone. What was it caused that? Why did it not carry on in the format?
I've thought about this. I've thought about this a lot. And I'm actually doing a book of anecdotes. So it's not going to be like a book, but it's just going to be like a book of anecdotes. And this got me to thinking about it. Bill, in 1977, he had a shop in Dundee called The Crypt. And what he would do is he'd get £10,000 in cash from his dad and £1,000 in each pocket. And Bill and I would go down and we'd buy clothes all around Margaret Street, that area of London. And as soon as you went in with the bish bosh, you get more discount. So that shop that Bill had, it was on 2 floors, okay, ground and basement, and it was in the Hilltown area of Dundee, and it was just like, you know, there was no real walls, it was just Hessian tacked onto flipping slats in the wall, and that was simple, right? And then in about 1978, there was the Wellgate Centre was opening up in Dundee, and that was like it was kind of like little stalls or bigger stalls, but there was no actual walls to the shop. Once you were inside the centre, you were there, so it meant suddenly you had a bigger shop, okay? And I'm drawing a parallel here because Bill loved this little shop, The Crypt, because no one bothered him and he was just left to get on with it. And when it got to being bigger, and suddenly, you had to be have 10 people around in the shops and you weren't making your own borders. That's kind of like what was lying ahead of Bill, and Bill could see it when we'd done Silk and we suddenly knew that we had to go out with two keyboard players as well as me on guitar and a backup singer and a female backup singer, you know, and suddenly it's just all too much, it's too big. And but that's what we were going to have to do, and Bill just didn't want to do it. And I draw that analogy because I could see exactly the same thing happening. And I think, you know, Bill was quite right to say, I've got pharyngitis, I can't do the tour. You know?
Yeah, okay. And then I get another big question. I know we spoke about this earlier and I said we'd come back to it.
Yeah.
So how do you think the record stands up? Where do you think are the big moments for you? Mm-hmm. Yeah. From this distance?
I don't know. If you were talking about, again, vocal performance, there's a certain things that vocalists do when they're not singing their own song. And I think Bill's best performance is Love Hangover, because you're free. You know, it's not so personal. It's not in the bones of yourself. Yes, you're using your whole body as your instrument, but there's something that's one step apart from it being your song, your lyrics. And I think that frees a singer up, because he had such fun doing that. You know, I don't think people realise, because we'd done all that cabaret stuff, and we'd done all, not just cabaret, but not just the chicken in a basket stuff, but we'd do miners' welfare clubs, and we'd have to learn 5 songs every Sunday, and then go and play them. But, you know, so when Bill and I were warming up in the studio, we'd be playing Brown Sugar and Jumpin' Jack Flash, and he'd be being Mick Jagger and all the rest of it. Or, you know, or suddenly be doing, you know, what's that track that Bowie did and the Stones did?
I don't know.
Let's Sleep Together.
Let's Spend the Night Together. Yeah. That's right, he did that on Penthouse,
yeah.
Didn't he? Yeah.
You know, so Bill would sometimes do Mick Jagger and then he'd change into Bowie and we'd do that, you know, just to warm up. And people sometimes thought we were taking the piss.
No, you would never do that.
No, I'd never do that.
Listen, thank you so much.
No, it's been
such
great,
a beautiful,
thank you.
Such a beautiful record, you know, to have made that, honestly.
Mm.
Thank you.
BBC Radio Scotland.
Check out the fully produced half-hour episode of Classic Scottish Albums about Silk. Lots of other great voices in the mix, as well as that otherworldly music. So that is us. We've reached 36 episodes. And you notice what? We're desperate to make more. That this is a beautiful thing to do. Thanks for all the suggestions you've been making across social media and also in the Apple Podcast app. The reviews, the ratings, so appreciated, and they do genuinely make a difference when we're pitching to produce more episodes for you. So hopefully a few more will be dropping at your feed soon. Keep sharing the back catalogue. Keep talking about classic Scottish albums. I'm Davey Scott. Thanks again for listening.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.